You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Andrew Day.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Can't complain. You're in Asheville? Your parents are visiting. Are your parents visiting?
They are. They got in yesterday. It's their second time visiting Asheville.
You know, one question I've never asked, and I'm kind of afraid to hear the answer to, is like, what do your parents think of me, Andrew? Because, you know, I'm your boss, and a lot of parents don't have the chance to see the bosses of their children, but yours do, because we do these video things. Do they hold me in very high regard?
Well, I can say the last time I went to cat sit for my parents and stayed at their house for a little while, I saw like three of your books on my mom's bookshelf, and she didn't have them before. Yeah, so that's a pretty positive review.
Does she know about the other two? Have you told her about the other two?
I'll let her know, yeah.
Well, God bless that woman. Mm-hmm. You come from good stock, Andrew. I've always wanted to tell you that. You come from good stock.
Appreciate it. I mean, as far as my dad, I don't know. I haven't asked.
I've got a feeling he has. I think he has reservations about me. That's my prediction.
He might, yeah. Your foreign policy views don't really align.
I was wondering how broad the overlap between my ideology and his is. He was like a big hockey player in his day, right?
Yeah, he was a big hockey player, and he was in the Army. He was 82nd Airborne. He's a Republican.
These are warning signs, ideology-wise. But the thing, you know, of course, I was an Army brat. My father was a lifer. Mm-hmm. You should like that part, right?
Right. Yeah,
but maybe that just makes him wonder where I went wrong.
Yeah, he might wonder the same thing about me. So,
well, I have no comment. So we put out the Friday edition of the Non-Zero newsletter, aka the Earthling. Some Fridays we record these things that involve our discussing some of the things and discussing things generally. And this week there's overlap, as there often is, between what we covering the newsletter and what's going on in the world, right?
Yeah. I mean, the lead item is about topical news. I've had a chance now to read it. Do you want to just kind of run through your argument? It's about this Anti-Semitism Awareness Act that just passed the House. I don't really know what the state of play is in the Senate, but we'll see.
Well, I'll tell you, it passed with overwhelming support in the House. So I don't know. I mean, obviously, the pro-Israel forces are arrayed behind it, supporting it. And as a rule in American politics, that is a good omen per policies. It's a horrible piece of legislation. I mean, the thing I try to point out in the piece, which I haven't seen really highlighted anywhere, is that a good example of what this would do is define something like accusing Israel of genocide as anti-Semitism. And in the context of the legislation, as I'll explain, that would mean the Department of Education could withdraw funding from any college that does not silence any student who says that. Mm-hmm. Because colleges, this is under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, colleges are held responsible for not tolerating discrimination on their campuses. Discrimination is defined to include harassment. And this piece of legislation would basically give you a template for how the Department of Education should look at discrimination toward harassment of Jews on campus, and it embraces this kind of controversial definition of anti-Semitism. What is the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition?
Alliance,
which comes with these nine examples of anti-Semitism, which the legislation mentions and embraces. And one of them is you cannot, I want to find the wording here, maybe you have it for you, but you cannot accuse Israel or comparing Israeli policies to policies practiced by the Nazis. And, you know, obviously, if you say Israel has committed genocide, you're doing that. If you, here it is, the exact wording is, drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. If you say that Israeli soldiers in the West Bank are practicing Gestapo tactics, that would be anti-Semitism under this bill. And, you know, say Trump's Department of Education, and this, I can well imagine this happening, because he has been nothing if not responsive to pro-Israel groups and donors last time around. I can well imagine Trump saying, if you let students say that, there goes this chunk of your federal funding. I can totally imagine that. I wouldn't completely rule out Biden doing it, but seems less likely. I should say, Trump himself passed an executive order that this pretty closely echoes. So there already is an executive order that would link Title VI of the Civil Rights Act to this definition of anti-Semitism, but it is just an executive order, which means any future president could revoke it. And it also means that if this gets challenged in court, I assume that the executive order would be more vulnerable to overturning than an actual piece of legislation. Since, after all, what we're talking about is how should you interpret the Civil Rights Act, and that's legislation, and this is legislation that, in effect, amends it, I guess. But, you know, which isn't to say that this couldn't fall on free speech grounds in the courts, but I think a law is less likely to do that than the executive order. So there's a lot of other problems with this that civil liberties groups have pointed to. I mean, a lot of other ways it is worrisome in how it would define speech that you could crack down on. But this one point that I focus on seems to me most kind of relevant to the issues of the moment.
Right. Yeah. And also at the state level, we've seen similar laws passed and governors have issued similar executive orders, which is strange because this definition by this International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance is not intended to have a legal status. I believe the author of it has said it shouldn't be incorporated into law. It shouldn't be codified as law. Mm-hmm. And yet it is anyway. And I totally agree with you that these examples make the definition seem completely vague. I mean, some of this stuff, you could even imagine kind of a philo-Semitic person saying, like when it says the applying double standards by requiring of it, that means Israel, a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. I mean, you can imagine someone saying, well, Israel should be better than other democratic nations because it's a moral society.
Right.
That's and I mean, the definition says, because these are just examples that go along with the definition, which I'll read part of it. Anti-Semitism is a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred toward Jews. So It doesn't by my reading of the definition, it could be that you have a certain perception of Jews that is expressed not in a hateful way. And it would still count as anti-Semitism according to this sort of weird definition. And yeah, I think, you know, if the Republicans had wanted to just pass a bill saying, and it wasn't just Republicans who did this, but they were kind of leading the charge in the House. If they wanted to pass a bill saying, you know, just kind of clarifying that anti-Semitism is covered by Title VI, you know, that would have been legitimate and reasonable if they had only said that. That's one of the things they said in the bill before laying out this definition. They would have still been able to have a title of a bill like anti-Semitism awareness, and they would have been able to deliver, you know, sanctimonious speeches on the House floor about the issue. But including the definition and expressly including the examples in that definition is clearly, it poses problems for free speech, obviously.
Yeah. Title VI was not originally construed as protecting Jews because it explicitly protects national groups and racial groups. And there's some other language, but it excludes religious groups. So if Jewish identity is a complicated thing, but if you defined it as fundamentally religious, it would seem to be excluded. But this bill has language that says, even if a group shares a religion, so long as some people construe it as having ethnic characteristics or something, shared ethnic characteristics, then it qualifies. So it makes it, I think over time, Jews have come to be seen as being covered by Title VI anyway, but this nails that down. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, as you say, puts forth a, you know, a pretty weird definition of anti-Semitism. And this is, you know, this is 100%, you know, a product of politically of the Israel lobby is broadly construed to mean not just AIPAC, but, you know, Anti-Defamation League. And there was a, you know, I mean, more than a dozen kind of pro-Israel groups in America have rallied behind it and applied pressure, or well, not all of them applied much pressure, but and, you know, I think ultimately this stuff backfires in certain ways. I talk about that a little in the piece. You know, I think the kind of unprecedentedly high amount of criticism of Israel we've seen among American elites is, of course, partly a reaction to what's going on in Gaza, for sure. But I also think that because speech has so long been policed by these pro-Israel groups, Anti-Defamation League, AIPAC, who accuse you of anti-Semitism if you say Israel practices apartheid, or if you say this or that, I think that's been going on for so long that once Gaza gave people clearly valid grounds for being critical, or clearly valid in most of our eyes, a dam kind of broke. And people who had kind of been frustrated by the speech policing kind of welcomed the opportunity to speak out. And I don't think we're ever going back entirely to the old world. And I don't think Israel will ever again enjoy the degree of a protection by kind of the speech police that it's accustomed to.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I would say, you know, I think that some, I mean, I'm speculating, but I would suspect that some university administrators might welcome the passage of this bill, because, you know, these big universities have obviously become businesses with huge endowments that are dependent on high tuitions and you know, big donations and sometimes kind of ethically sketchy investments. And it's not good for that business model to have a bunch of pro-Palestinian protesters, you know, setting up encampments and saying that they want the university to divest from Israel. So the politics of this are kind of complicated, I think. And that's one thing I wanted to talk about, like the partisan electoral politics of all of this, and how Biden or Trump will be advantaged or disadvantaged. But maybe before doing that, do you want to talk about this situation at UCLA and maybe the protests more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, in
broadly?
General, this is the situation at campuses. I mean, as you mentioned, college presidents are kind of not happy about the plight they face at the moment. But of course, one reason is they've seen two college presidents lose their jobs because I don't know, they, you know, and this comes again, you know, I get back to this, in my view, kind of backfiring or not being, you know, in both cases, there was a pretty pro-Israel big donor who basically threatened, made noises about varying degrees of explicitness about withdrawing, you know, not donating huge sums of money if they didn't crack down on the speech that the donors didn't like. And I think, and well, first of all, these presidents lost their jobs. Of course, in Harvard, I think she would have hung in there if they hadn't dug up that stuff about plagiarism in her past. I think the university kind of wanted to stand behind her. That made it a bridge too far. But in any event, these presidents are worried. I mean, I think that's one reason they're cracking down. They're arresting people and they're cracking down in ways they didn't. I mean, at Princeton, for example, you know, they've occupied the president's office and stuff. Nobody's arrested, but they're arresting people now. Mm-hmm. And anyway, to get back to the way it backfires, I just think, I mean, first of all, you know, this is totally, it's fodder for, I mean, I don't I don't know what's going on in anti-Semitic cesspools at this moment online, but I assume that this is just for them. This is just, they consider this great, like, recruiting material, you know, like it affirms their worldview that there's some giant conspiracy and they, you know, and I don't think that's good. Now, you know, obviously you say things like this and people say, so wait, you're blaming Jews for anti-Semitism? No, I'm just saying, I'm just trying to point to a causal connection that I think maybe, you know, if these various pro-Israel actors, including groups, focused on, they might ask themselves how much of this is good for them in the end. I think the speech policing is kind of coming home to roost in two ways. Leave the anti-Semitism aside. But again, I think it is partly, you know, kind of simmering frustration about it. You're seeing expressed in the number of elites that are criticizing Israel.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I mean, as far as the kind of politics of this, I wonder if what you think about my theory that, kind of depending on how Trump and Biden react to all of this going forward, that this could be good for Biden. I mean, the Gaza war is not good for him, but the campus protests and the Republican reaction, I think, might be, because he can kind of position himself as a moderate, because the Republican response to this has been so over the top, with its most prominent spokespeople, most prominent Republicans calling these encampments little Gazas that are pro-Hamas and they need to be shut down immediately. So that kind of extremely pro-Israel position is sort of being recoded as the right-wing position. You know what I mean? And I think the average American looking at this, we know from opinion polls that they're critical of the war in Gaza. They want a ceasefire. They're opposed to more U.S. funding. But I would imagine a lot of them are also not too happy about these protests. They don't naturally have kind of instinctive sympathy for, like, left-wing protesters who are occupying buildings. And Biden, I think, has an opportunity to position himself as sort of in the middle of this, like the sane, normal, reasonable person. I don't think he is, but it seems to me that that's how it could shake out. And based on his speech the other day, I think that that's what they're trying to do, because he was saying, you know, he was kind of defending in the abstract the protesters' right to free speech, but then also saying vandalism is unacceptable. He said he opposed the National Guard going in and breaking things up, but his speech also in certain moments had a kind of law and order vibe. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on
well,
that?
I didn't hear the whole thing. You listened to the whole Biden speech. All anybody is all that's getting replayed is the law and order part.
Yeah.
Protesting is fine, but disruption is not, like, that part.
Yeah. He said dissent shouldn't lead to disorder. And
yeah.
And he also, you know, he did this thing where he lists all these protest actions and then says, these are not peaceful. And then you think, well, actually some of those are peaceful, you know. So
it seems to me he's 100% playing the law and order crowd card, and I think that's because he senses that this is a vulnerability. I mean, Trump is salivating over this. There's nothing better for Trump than chaos breaking out in America as the election approaches under Biden. And so, you know, I think this also accounts for how after I saw the part where, when he's done, some reporter says, have the protests led you to change your mind about any aspect of anything? He's like, no. Mm-hmm. Protesters bad. Basically, he didn't say the protesters bad part, but that's how he seems to want to identify himself. And I will say, look, I wish the messaging of the protesters were different. I wrote about this last week in the Non-Zero newsletter. Because they would have broader support if this were identified as an anti-war movement. It's not. The protests are always called pro-Palestinian, which I think is fine. I think Palestinians deserve the equal rights that they do not have in the West Bank and God knows Gaza. You know, as in terms of the American politics, stop the war is a much more broadly appealing message. And I'm sure most Americans get freaked out when they see a Palestinian flag.
Mm-hmm.
So You know, so naturally, you know, I mean, Biden's in it, but I continue to think Biden basically can't win here, unless he, you know, brings a halt to the Gaza war and gets credit for that or something. But the protests are a problem for him.
I mean, just to kind of flesh out what I mean, like some of these videos that I've seen, the most recent one I saw at UCLA, when the police are coming in and cracking down on the encampment, there are young men standing nearby chanting Trump's name. You know, Trump is associated, in their minds at least, with the crackdown. But I don't know if Biden is necessarily associated with the protesters fully. But, you know, Republicans would like him to be. They're calling it like Biden's chaos. Yeah. You know?
And he's trying to disassociate himself from that. But I also don't think that. I mean, first of all, I don't think Trump minds being associated with the police.
No, I don't think
so. Law and order is a winning message when probably in any country where chaos seems to be breaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll tell you, I was very disappointed. I think this was a dereliction of Biden's duty as president. I mean, and before I say this, let's back up and talk about UCLA a little more. Mm-hmm. It seems pretty clear, although this was not clearly reported very prominently in most newspapers, that first of all, UCLA is the most worrying outbreak of violence between protesters and counter-protesters. And secondly, it was fundamentally instigated by the pro-Israel side. The Los Angeles Times has reported this very clearly. The video seems to clearly bear it out, although it's piecemeal, and maybe there's video I haven't seen, but I try to follow enough different kinds of people so that I see all the video both sides are putting out. Video I've seen makes it very clear that, and you know, the Wall Street Journal gets credit for pretty early on, they at least reported this much. The counter-protesters attacked the barricades. Then they started throwing pieces of the barricades at the protesters. Then they started firing fireworks into the encampment. You know, that doesn't cover all of it. There were just, you know, physical assaults that I saw on person on person initiated by the pro-Israel side. And there was also, this was at night. And then I also saw footage from the day. And I don't know which day. I don't know if it's the same day or a couple of days earlier or what, but these are actual Israelis, the daytime footage with Israeli accents and older, you know, clearly not students.
Mm-hmm.
And they were being very aggressive. But so anyway, you know, New York Times had a piece today, 2 days after the fact, kind of conveying that the pro-Israel side did the attacking, not exactly going out of its way to say that. The Wall Street Journal early on got it kind of right, somewhat prominently. LA Times has been very good, but by and large, it just seems to me like this is something to focus on. First big outbreak of violence between protesters, counter-protesters. Obviously, this is what you worry about, whether it's red on blue, pro-Israel, anti-Israel, you know, this can spread. It's exactly what you want not to happen. It seems to me when it first happens, your you know, reputable journalistic outlets would take a close look at all the evidence and try to tell you exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. New York Times hasn't done that. Washington Post hasn't done that. Even the Journal hasn't really done that. Anyway, back to Biden. I think. I this might have even been politically wise to pick up a little credit from, you know, the progressives to say, you know, having said all that, whatever, all the stuff he said about, you know, disruption isn't protest, say at the same time, I want to say to counter protesters, leave the policing to the police.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you think about barricades or anything else, keep your hands off, because we will prosecute you just as for any violation of law, just as we will prosecute protesters. I honestly don't think like pro-Israel people would have been upset by that. I think most of them don't want violence to spread across the country. But I also think if he were a good president, he would have said that. That was in a situation like this. This is what separates your really good presidents from your Joe Bidens. You know, That was the responsible thing to say, and he didn't say it.
Yeah, that example of UCLA really highlights what seems like a breakdown, like a breakdown in civilization and law and order. Because not only were there these vigilante pro-Israel people who were totally aggressing against the encampment there, but then afterwards, the protesters who were attacked were trying to identify their attackers themselves and dox them online and, you know, expose them more broadly. And there was just kind of this sense that, you know, the normal mechanisms of the justice system were not happening in this instance. And I did also get the sense watching those videos that these pro-Israel protesters, I mean, they were behaving so boldly, like they clearly felt like they had license to do this and they didn't expect any repercussions.
I think they do. Mm-hmm. I think our media is giving them license with the exception of Los Angeles Times. I think Biden is giving them license. He didn't say what he should have said. And we'll see if the police follow up on what you said. There was this piece in the LA Times about the pro-Palestinian protesters trying to establish the identities of these people. You know, we'll see if the police pick up on that. But sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, that's all that I wanted to say. That's just something that stuck out to me. I guess I was going to say, like, there does seem to be a kind of moral panic right now about anti-Semitism. I don't doubt that some slogans have been chanted in by some protesters that, you know, that I would consider anti-Semitic. But one reason these counter protesters felt they had license might have been because they really thought that they were like fighting against anti-Semitism, you know, because that's what everyone is saying. I don't know if you saw like this Dana Bash CNN monologue.
Oh God, she is the worst.
Yeah, that was terrible.
That was like, I tweeted that and said, this sounds like a Trump campaign ad.
Right.
America is like Europe in the 1930s.
Yeah, like, she literally said that. Mm-hmm.
The closest thing I've seen to Europe in the 1930s is what those pro-Israel protesters did at UCLA. And I mean that. That was the closest. That looked more like brown shirt activity than anything I've seen. And we will see if policing authorities actually follow up and try to find these people and prosecute them. Because I think there's enough footage, even though they're wearing masks, it sounds like there's been enough success plausibly identifying some that the police should at least find out whether these tentative IDs hold up.
Right. So it's been about 30 minutes. So I think it's time for the paywall to come down or go up, whatever we say. Maybe I could just mention some of the topics we're going to discuss. We're going to discuss the Ukraine war. Russia is kind of on the offensive. Some people are hoping that the $61 billion Ukraine aid package can sort of turn the tide. So we're going to be looking at that. We've got a bunch of AI-related content. And then we're going to be talking about this plastics treaty.
Now, do you know what a person of my generation thinks of when you say plastics?
No, I don't.
The super famous line in the movie The Graduate.
I've seen the movie, but I don't know the line.
Dustin Hoffman has just graduated from college, and you know he doesn't know what he's going to do for a living. And one of his parents' friends, this guy, walks up to him and says, "I have one word for you: plastics." He wants him. He says, "Like that's the wave of the future." Sadly, he was right.
Yeah, we include some stats in today's Earthling that vindicate that advice. So. But yeah, people should go to Non-Zero on Substack, the Non-Zero newsletter. You can just Google Non-Zero Substack. It'll take you right there if you want to become an NZN member and get access to the rest of this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Which, why wouldn't you? I don't understand it. Mm-hmm. Are there Americans who are not? Do we not yet have 350 million paid subscribers? It's shocking.
We're on our way. Okay.
So we are heading into overtime. Thanks to everybody who's watched this far. Hope you'll watch the rest.
This was a free preview of Earthling Unplugged. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive audio content, Become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.